Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's Tuesday, February 18th. Currently 22 degrees, a little bit of blue sky, some clouds out there. Our weather window with, again, 22 degrees. Heber City reporting 25 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, I'll tell you what, we're starting off quiet in a lot of spots, but I do want to caution that we will see some more snow showers as we go throughout this morning into the early afternoon hour. So while there may be a little blue sky now, they expect those clouds to roll back in with some snow showers moving back in. We're already seeing part of that coming through the Salt Lake Valley. Now, as we go throughout the day, temperatures will stay on the chilly side out there. We're looking at those highs right around freezing in Park City with highs in the upper 30s to near 40 in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into your Wednesday, don't get too used to the quiet weather. We'll start off chilly out there with temperatures down into the teens, with highs on your Wednesday only in the mid-30s in Park City and highs around 40 degrees in the Heber Valley. But here we go. We've got another winter weather event that moves into the state as we get into your Wednesday night into Thursday. So if you wanted more snow, we've got some in the forecast for you here. We're looking at snow becoming likely as we go into your Wednesday night in the both Park City and the Heber Valley. And snow will be likely as we go throughout your day on Thursday. And that snow will likely accumulate to several more inches. We're probably looking at another decent storm for our mountain locations here coming in. And again, for the Heber Valley, with those temperatures staying on the chilly side, 20s Thursday morning, with highs only in the 30s during the day on Thursday. So get ready for another snowy scene and probably have to do some shoveling again as we get into our Wednesday night into Thursday. Otherwise, as we go into the rest of the week, we're looking at drier conditions as we get into your Thursday, with temperatures starting off into the teens and highs warming into the mid to upper 30s across the area as we go into your Thursday. As we get into your Friday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies, temperatures dropping down into the teens with highs only in the low to mid 40s as we go throughout the afternoon to finish your week. And we've got a pretty decent weekend heading our way. That's some good news that I get to report to you here. We're looking at those lows starting off into the 20s during the weekend, but high temperatures on Saturday, mid 40s for Park City. We're in the upper 40s as we get into the Heber Valley. And by Sunday, we're talking about temperatures only dropping down to around the freezing mark, with highs in the upper 40s in Park City and highs in the low 50s as we get into the Heber Valley there. So a little taste of spring heading our way just in time for the upcoming weekend. But we still have to get through some winter weather. Again, today expect some scattered snow showers as we go throughout the morning hours into the early afternoon before drying out. And then we've got a bigger snow potential returning to the area for our Wednesday night into Thursday. Make sure you have those shovels ready as we're looking at more decent snow accumulation probably heading for both to Park City and for the Heber Valley. So, Leslie, winter is showing its face here.
Okay, thanks, Cedric. And taking a look in the backcountry from the Utah Avalanche Center, we've got Paige on the line. Good morning, Paige.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great, thanks.
All right, so today the avalanche danger is considerable on all aspects and elevations. Human-triggered avalanches are likely on most slopes, especially on those with buried reclairs. Our travel advice today is to continue to avoid travel in avalanche terrain. Widespread signs of instability are slowly decreasing as our natural avalanches, but the fact remains that none of us at the Avalanche Center or in the snow industry trust the snowpack. We've seen avalanches on almost every aspect and elevation in the past 5 days. And because there are multiple weak layers, we can't be sure which one will fail. I don't encourage anyone to try to navigate the hazard right now. There's plenty of excellent powder riding that can be found on slopes less than 30 degrees. Yesterday, there was a close call in Big Cottonwood where a skier triggered an avalanche and was able to grab a tree branch and let the snow wash around them. Just a reminder that you got to keep your slope angles under 30 degrees. Today, we're dealing with persistent weak layers and wind-drifted snow at mid and upper elevations.
Okay, and what we've heard is that it's not just one persistent weak layer. There are layers of persistent weak layers, huh?
Yeah, it's a pretty complicated snowpack for this time of year in the central Wasatch and in the Wasatch in general. We've got facets from early season slopes that avalanche previously called repeaters where the facets still exist. We've got January faceted snow, and now on our southeast facing slopes, we have a facet crust combo. So definitely getting complicated and complex. But the answer to that is always moving to simpler terrain, so slopes less than 30 degrees.
And with the new snow on its way Wednesday night into Thursday, is that going to help things or just make it worse?
It'll probably increase avalanche danger, but continue to improve riding conditions. So based on the weather report, I'd say that everybody should be trying to get their powder fill in. Because the temperatures are going to start warming up, and February 19th is the end of powder season. So better get your skiing in, but keep the slope angles low.
Oh, I never knew that date about February. That's kind of the official end of powder season.
Well, the sun angle gets high enough that it starts to zap the snow pretty quickly. So,
All right. Thanks, Paige. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. He'll have a preview of this week's County Council meeting. Later on, a Utah legislative report, KUER reporter Sean Higgins checking in, and Recycle Utah General Manager Jim Bedell will have the latest on the location for a new center, as well as a preview of a couple upcoming events. Then stay tuned for This Green Earth. Today's guests are Jackson Lusatia, Solos Marumpi, and Tim LePage from Park City, talking about the new Rupoi Nature Conservancy in Kenya. The conservancy was created to expand the protected land for wildlife. All of that coming up on today's edition of This Green Earth, of course, heard every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The Wasatch County Council meets Wednesday starting at 4 o'clock. And on the phone with a preview of the meeting, I have Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first up is a $2,000 contribution to Utah Teen Adaptive Hope. I'm guessing this is to help, what, Gavin Peterson with his travel expenses?
Yeah, so this is a not-for-profit to support wheelchair athletes, and Gavin Peterson is one of those potential recipients.
Okay, and I'd like to direct people to kpcw.org to hear a wonderful story that our reporter Grace Dorfler did with Gavin over the weekend. Wallsburg is getting new fire hydrants or got new fire hydrants?
Yeah, so Wallsburg City was doing a water pipe project, and as part of that project, they installed some additional fire hydrants that the fire district felt like would be, highly needed. It ultimately cost about $45,000 for 9 hydrants, which if any one of those hydrants is needed to save a structure, will more than make up for the cost of those installations. So we're splitting it between the county and the fire district.
Okay, so are more hydrants needed?
I think this is based on what the area that they installed them, that we have a lot of really good coverage there. There are probably opportunities. It'd be best if every house had a fire hydrant in front of them, but ultimately we tried to look for the most efficient use of resources, and we felt like this was the right match in this circumstance.
Okay, but I guess going forward is what I'm asking. I mean, you've added these 9, but maybe you need more?
No, I don't think there's any plans right now for additional fire hydrants.
Okay, and as you mentioned, the cost will be split, but it sounds like the county is actually fronting the money?
Yeah, so rather than cut two different checks, we're cutting one check and then repaying, the fire district will repay the county for our portion.
Okay, in one payment, not over time.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Also on the agenda, a Wasatch County Council member will be appointed to serve on the Community Alliance for Main Street, the acronym CAMS. Is this a voting position?
I believe so. CAMS Executive Director Rachel Kaler reached out the other week and said that by their bylaws, they intended to invite someone like a county council member. So they extended an invitation and we're responding to that.
Okay, so what does this alliance do?
So it's a business alliance for the Main Street part of Heber. And they do a lot of different things. They do grants and other programs to try and ensure that there's investment and revitalization. They coordinate efforts on things that they are doing to try and make sure that the tide rises for all the businesses on Main Street in Heber.
Okay, and has a council member stepped up to take this on, or?
We haven't had a seat on the board typically. It was through Rachel's effort that we now will have, and we actually hadn't really discussed it at a county council meeting yet, other than to inform the council that this request had been made and that we would be scheduling it. So I expect someone will be interested in, one of the council members will be interested in serving on Wednesday.
Okay. Hey, let's get your take on the new lawsuit against Heber Valley Special Service District. You have commented in the past about how leaders are interested in credible concerns about the facilities.
Yeah, I don't know the details of it. And typically when we have active litigation, we tend to not comment a whole lot. But I think in general, the Gila Valley Service District is, through their new director, making a lot of really great strides. I think the improvement was evident this last summer, and I think they continue to make those improvements. So, like I said, I don't know the details of the circumstances, but I think we have a lot of confidence that we're headed the right way.
Well, what we heard from the attorney is that while they would have liked to have addressed the concerns outside of court, and again, the concerns just being the obnoxious smells, he said one of the things that tipped the balance was the district's recent application to become an industrial protection zone, a designation that would have shielded the area from what you have described as frivolous lawsuits. But if people's sleep is being disrupted and they're not happy, that doesn't sound frivolous.
Yeah, no, I think it's more about the changes that need to be made at the HVSSE district are being made, that sometimes there are lawsuits in circumstances like this is it's a agricultural and industrial protection area. The normal operations of either an agriculture business or a business like this, sometimes people find, problems with them and sue over those things. So to the extent that it's a normal operation of that business, that's what that would protect against. But if there are other issues, whether or not it's in an agricultural and industrial protection area, isn't going to prevent any kind of lawsuit. That, again, that doesn't prevent anyone in any community from being able to ensure that these legitimate concerns are being addressed. And I think ultimately that's what we're hoping that this process will be able to identify as what can be done, what should be done, and what's the best way forward.
Yeah, and I guess the issue is growth, right? I mean, this was originally built, these lagoons or these ponds, for a very rural area, which has now exploded in growth and will continue to grow. So it just sounds like maybe we need to do something different, and whose responsibility is that?
Yeah, we had a presentation a few weeks ago from the Midway mayor and the director of HVSSD that explained that we have existing capacity for some of the projected growth, but at some point the existing capacity will be insufficient. And that's part of what they've tasked Jim, who is that director, with addressing, is making sure that we know how much we can handle, and if we can't, they can refuse additional connections. Ultimately, those things might end up in other waste treatment facilities or new facilities even.
And then just go away altogether.
Yeah, so, I mean, it all kind of depends on the scope and location and how we choose to handle wastewater treatment facilities.
Hmm. All right, so is that moving forward? I mean, is that on somebody's work plan? To begin
yeah,
looking at that?
Yeah. They gave us a kind of a timeline of when they expected to have additional capacity and or at least how long they expect to be able to utilize the existing capacities, and then what things we might be able to do to assure that we gain additional capacity. But I think ultimately that facility does have a limit of how much it can take.
All right. UDOT recently gave the county council the latest update on the bypass. It seems like the communication between UDOT and the county has improved quite a bit. Was there a request for more frequent updates?
Yeah, actually, a few months ago, I think all of the communities in Wasatch County felt like they would love to be included more in these updates. And UDOT committed back in last fall to come back on a monthly basis at least with each entity and present. They also came to our interlocal meeting earlier this year, and I think we've been really pleased to hear from them on this more regular cadence to see what the status updates of the project are.
Yeah, and have you received any feedback from residents about the progress with UDOT?
Yeah, I think there are always people who have, expressed concerns around some of the proposed alternatives, and people who have kind of creative solutions to try to address them. Those are things that we typically pass along to UDOT so that they can incorporate it into their study.
Yeah, and what do you think, or the county, think about the pace of work? I mean, it sounds like it's going to be this fall before we find out their preferred location.
You know, I think everyone feels like this is something that should have been done decades ago, but the best time to plant a tree is either 20 years ago or today. So I think we're happy that we are going forward where we now. And I think that we actually expect to receive the revised draft alternative screening report in just a few weeks, ultimately.
And if UDOT should choose a location that the community just does not want, is there anything that can be done? I mean, is it you either live with it or you don't get something done?
I think UDOT is responsive to community concerns and needs, and I think that's part of the dialogue that we've been having, is making sure that we express to UDOT all of the concerns. But at the end of the day, I think the intent of the project is to try and look at all of the issues included, including as many perspectives as possible, and to evaluate them in an objective way so that it's not just someone's opinion on what the right thing is, that if they can point to the right alternative based on incorporating all of this feedback, I think we hope that we can get to a solution that is palatable for at least the majority of the community.
All right. Destin, anything else you'd like to mention?
No, not today.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, a handful of Midway residents are suing the Heber Valley Special Service District. They allege the odor of the wastewater treatment ponds causes health problems and hurts their property values. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Midway locals have complained for years that the smell of the treatment ponds disrupts daily life, especially when the seasons change. But some residents also worry the ponds are a health hazard. Now, four Midway homeowners are turning to the legal system to try to address the stench. In a lawsuit filed Friday in 4th District Court, the residents alleged the service district minimized their concerns and failed to do enough to fix the problem. The resident's attorney, Eric Vogeler, writes that the district's alleged failure to adequately maintain the facility has resulted in significant and traumatizing personal injury to and illness in his clients and significant devaluation of their home values. Among the health issues cited by residents in the lawsuit are headaches, nasal congestion, nausea, and sleep disruption. The lawsuit asks the district to address the alleged problems and compensate the residents for the wrongs they say they've suffered. Vogeler says he expects to represent a larger group of residents as the lawsuit proceeds.
We fully expect that there are other neighbors in that vicinity who would or will join the lawsuit. We just felt it was incumbent on us to act quickly and start the ball rolling.
He says his clients would have preferred to address their concerns outside of court. He says one of the things that tipped the balance was the district's recent application to become an industrial protection zone, a designation that would have shielded the area from what Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow described as frivolous lawsuits.
I think everyone has been very hesitant to sue. At a town hall meeting, the HVSSD chair stated that one of the reasons they wanted to designate it as a protected industrial area was to make HVSSD immune from lawsuits, so that a lawsuit like this couldn't be brought. And that's very concerning, I think.
Local leaders explained last fall the district would still be liable for legitimate health and safety issues if it became an industrial protection zone. But the district later withdrew the application after Midway residents and leaders shared concerns about the optics of the move. Vogeler says his clients sued because they no longer trust that the district will act with any sense of urgency to address the odors and the alleged health impacts.
Our plaintiffs are not looking for a windfall. They adore the Heber Valley, and they're just despondent that they can't enjoy their property in the way they had hoped. And the thought that they not only can't enjoy it in the way they thought, but that one day, if they do ever have to move, they'll take a huge financial hit. It's heartbreaking for them.
He says one of the biggest questions in the lawsuit is whether the district has done enough to meet the needs of the growing community.
One of the things we said in our complaint was that lagoons are, while they're relatively common for wastewater treatment plants, they're typically a rural solution. And when they were installed in Heber Valley, that area was almost certainly very rural. Now it's suburban.
He says it's possible the district should have adopted a different means of managing the valley's wastewater. But others argue the issue stems from county residents' relatively recent proximity to the treatment plant. Graybow, the county manager, has said the main change is new construction near the sewer ponds, rather than negligence on the district's part. The district was not immediately available for comment on the President's Day holiday. Meanwhile, scientists are still working to understand what causes the smell and what health effects, if any, the ponds might have. Researchers from Utah's Environmental Epidemiology Program are conducting a risk assessment for a toxin called hydrogen sulfide, which has a rotten egg smell and can cause symptoms like headaches, fatigue, and respiratory problems. Data collection ran through summer 2024 and will resume around mid-April. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Library and Park City Film have a treat for those who are in town for winter break. Free family films and popcorn at the Jim Santee Auditorium this week. Matinee screenings start today and will run through Friday. Executive Director of Park City Film, Katie Wang, says that they're offering some family classics.
We're starting off with one of the classics, one of my favorites. That's when I was a kid, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Then we have The Wild Robot, which also is critically acclaimed, came out this fall. Thursday night is Paddington, the original. The sequel is coming out here shortly. And then Friday, the original Beetlejuice. So all at 4 o'clock, all free admission, free popcorn, bring your friends and family.
The February Break Series is sponsored by funding in part from the Summit County Recreation Arts and Parks, or RAP Tax, which helps pay for the free popcorn as well as all of the film licensing. Again, every afternoon starting at 4 o'clock. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour, joined now on the phone by KUER government politics reporter Sean Higgins. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's get right to it. Lots to cover. Let's start with HB 267, which was signed into law. We had heard last that if the governor had vetoed the bill, the numbers likely weren't there to override it. Any idea, any sense of why he did go ahead and sign it?
Well, looking at the governor's statement, I really get the feeling that there was a sense that he didn't really want to spend too much political capital by vetoing this so early in the session. I mean, the unionization, like workers' rights in general, are somewhat of a touchy subject here in Utah. Utah is a right to work state. You don't have to be part of a union to work in a workplace that does have a union present. And looking at the governor's statement, he said he was disappointed that the process did not ultimately deliver the compromise that at one point was on the table and that some stakeholders had accepted. When this process was slowing down in the Senate, we heard there was a compromise on the table that would allow for collective bargaining if unions essentially recertified every 5 or so years. There was a lot of hope from labor leaders that this was a genuine compromise that a lot of people could get behind. What we heard from senators was that they wanted more or less unanimous support from unions, or else this compromise was off the table. And apparently not everyone was able to get on board with everything this compromise bill was going to do. So senators pushed ahead anyways.
Okay, again, HB 267, which basically bans collective bargaining unions for all public sector employees. Let's follow that up with Senate Bill 37. With the teachers union, UEA, now out of the way, SB 37 would require school districts to deposit all property tax revenue into a state general fund, which then could be used for the minimum education funding and anything else that lawmakers wanted. Is that true?
These tax amendment bills can be very, very complicated when we're looking at them. And I have to tell you, I'm not a tax expert, and I was reading through this bill this morning, and it sounds like they're really trying to get creative with how which strings they can pull for education funding and these other areas. As a lot of people remember from last year with Amendment A to the Utah Constitution, that was eventually not allowed to go on the ballot for technical reasons. That would have changed the state constitution to allow for a state income tax to fund more than just education. I get the sense that this is along those same lines. State lawmakers are trying to find different ways to allocate money throughout the system when it comes to tax revenue, because some of it is enshrined in the state constitution, and that's very hard to change, as opposed to just a code change for a normal tax law. So I get the sense that it's along those lines.
Well, and you're kind to use the word creative ways to find more funding. It sounds to me like an end run around the fact that Amendment A didn't get the voter approval that it needed to allow the legislature to use income tax revenue for other state needs. But is this correct? I mean, it sounds like this money could be used for anything. It could rebuild State Route 224 for us, or it could be build the Heber Bypass and used for anything besides education.
Well, I will say that definitely the rhetoric from the supermajority when it comes to this education funding and opening up new avenues to use sources of funds that had been traditionally used for just education is, hey, trust us. Whether you trust them or not, I think is up to each individual person. There's a lot of people who make the argument that, hey, Utah is not going to gut public education. We really care about our public education. People look at the weighted pupil unit and say differently, depending on your views on public education. But I think this really fits into that broader narrative, like you were saying, that they're really trying to find alternative ways to get what they really want.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, House Bill 300. This is the voter ID and mail-in voting. What's the update on that? It sounds like it's kind of stalled at this point.
Yeah, so this bill has been circled in the House. So basically, they pressed the pause button. That was circled on February 11th. And I haven't heard any updates since then. But looking back at the committee discussion on a lot of this, a lot of Republicans were very skeptical of some of the more broad changes this bill would do. The bill sponsor said that there would be some amendments made, some substitutes made. And a lot of the Republicans in the committee basically said, like, my yes vote in committee to advance this does not guarantee my yes vote on the floor because I have not seen these changes, but I will take you at your word. And we have not seen any substitutions yet. I have a feeling this one could be watered down quite a bit, but a version of it could be pushed forward. I mean, looking at some of the, I mean, I'm looking at the original version right now since we don't have a substitute. This would make some really real sweeping changes to the way voter ID and our mail-in voting system works. Effectively, you would be getting your ballot in the mail, but you could not then return it in the mail. You'd have to go to a physical drop-off location, show an ID there as you drop your ballot off. A lot of this stems from the discussions over the last 4+ years about election security. Utah has not been immune to some of those more national conversations, even though poll after poll after poll shows pretty overwhelming confidence in our elections here in Utah across the political spectrum. There is a very vocal minority on certain corners of the internet that will tell you otherwise. And I get the feeling that some version of this bill will be moving forward. I have a feeling that it will be quite watered down, maybe an opt-in or an opt-out clause where people could opt in to showing their ID or something along those lines. But this bill has the support of party leadership. So I think in some version, this bill will be moving forward. What that version looks like yet is yet to be seen.
Yeah, and I don't know whether or not a cost has been determined on what this would cost, because it would require two election officials to be at each ballot drop-off location, and it's who bears that cost? Is it local counties, or is it, you know, just another unfunded mandate?
Yeah, I mean, I would assume it would be local counties, because counties run elections. When you look at the actually how things are run, yes, elections are overseen by the Lieutenant Governor's office, but elections are run on a county-by-county basis by your county clerks and are funded by your tax dollars.
Moving on to House Bill 77. This was basically the bill that would ban pride flags from being displayed at public schools. It sounds like it was also quickly amended when it was discovered that schools could display Nazi or Confederate flags if, in fact, they were part of the curriculum. So how was the bill amended?
I'm looking at the bill right now, and the way I'm reading it is it would only allow flags to be flown under a certain set of parameters. So the United States flag, the official flag of Utah, flags that represent a city or municipality, military flags, other flags that are kind of more government related are would be allowed under this bill. But what you're talking about is there's a section that says a historic version of a flag described in subsections state code that is temporarily displayed for educational purposes. So one could make an argument that a flag like the Nazi flag or the Confederate flag or a South African apartheid flag, something of that nature, could be shown in a classroom in an educational setting. And this really goes back to this more national conversation about the politics of pride flags. I know a lot of people on the political right have issue with what they see as a political agenda when it comes to pride flags. There's been a big effort to curb a lot of that, particularly in schools. The representative who is running this bill, Trevor Lee, is one of the most conservative members of the supermajority. He's quite young as well. I believe he's in his early 30s and has really been a champion of these more red meat conservative bills over the last couple of years. This did make it out of committee on a strict party line vote. This is another one that I think could pass in some capacity, but it would be changed. Like you said, it has already been changed. There's been bills in the past to look at how flags are displayed in schools with a little bit of flavoring that are a little bit of bias toward LGBTQ pride flags as well. So we're really just keeping an eye on this one right now.
Yeah, and the sponsor of the bill, as you mentioned, Representative Lee had told the Salt Lake Tribune, you don't censor history, and yet it took a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2015 to allow same-sex marriage. That is history, so I don't understand how pride flags would not be allowed under that reasoning. I mean, what's the difference?
I think you could totally make a good argument that pride flags are historical, and you could be teaching a unit of American history all about the Stonewall riots and the start of the gay rights movement, mm-hmm. and you could be flying a pride flag in class. And I think maybe that could be an exception under this bill where you could fly that flag.
All right. Senate Bill 277. This, of course, very important for you and me as reporters. It would basically dismantle the State Records Committee that's worked pretty good for three decades and replaces it with a single appointed lawyer or records office director to decide which records should be public. My understanding is that it gets its first hearing today.
Yeah, that is in committee this afternoon. This is by Senator Mike McKell. He's one of the newer members of Republican leadership in the Senate. And Utah is an interesting case when it comes to these public record laws. Utah has long been considered to have a very robust public records law, very lenient to what you can request from a government agency. I think journalists file them all the time, but as a regular resident of Utah, you are allowed to do these things too. You're allowed to request police reports. You're allowed to request things of your city council members about discussions of certain projects if they've done those discussions in an official capacity, but not in a public meeting. And this, some people have said, this is an effort to chip away at the public access to records. We've seen some of this in bills already. There's some water bills that were passed last year where the content of those meetings is not subject to these grandma laws, these public record laws. Some said that was just an erosion of public trust when it comes to what these public officials are talking about. People made the argument that water negotiations are fraught to begin with, and having these protected will allow people to speak more honestly when it comes to what they really think when it comes to where water should be allocated throughout the state. As pertains to this bill, replacing the committee with a single person, I think some people are saying, like, hey, the committee's worked great for a long time. Why are we changing this? Are we putting this in one person's hands for political reasons, to just kind of further insulate our lawmakers from being accountable to us as voters? I think we'll learn more this afternoon. I think there'll be some senators with some tough questions for Senator McKell when he's in front of the committee asking them to move this bill forward. But yeah, I think public records, everyone should care about it, not just journalists. I think anyone who cares about what our elected officials are saying and how they're using our tax dollars should care about these public records laws.
Okay. Again, on that one, stay tuned. Let's talk about some of the immigration bills making their way through the state legislature.
Yeah, so some of this started moving last week. We had a bill, namely from Representative Candace Perucci, who would, or this is House Bill 226. This is kind of one of the flagship immigration public safety related bills that Republicans rolled out before the session started. Essentially, what this bill does is it ups the prison sentence for certain class A misdemeanors from 364 days to 365 days, so a full calendar year. And my colleague Macy Lepkin, who covers bilingual communities in northern Utah, has called this weird intersection between state and federal law, where a 365-day sentence in the eyes of the federal government is what is called an aggravated felony, even though it is a misdemeanor as far as state law is concerned. And the consequences of that from an immigration standpoint is a 365-day sentence makes someone eligible for deportation after they are released from prison. So obviously a lot of discussion over the last year, certainly 2024 election was immigration was a huge component to that, and a very big issue for a lot of voters. And the Republicans are really responding to that. They want to crack down on illegal immigration in the state. This is one of those bills that is aimed to deter people from possibly coming here at all, especially if they intend on committing crime once they get here. And talking to some of these Republican sponsors, they see it as coming at this issue with a scalpel rather than a sledgehammer. I spoke with Representative Perucci before the session started about all of this, and she said they're really focusing on crime, on people who come here without legal status and are committing crimes in our communities. They're not going after people who don't have legal status just for being here without legal status. But when you talk to Democrats and some immigration advocates, they're really quite worried about the rhetoric and people getting swept up in all this who maybe just look different than everyone else and not speak English as their first language. So this is moving through. It passed the House last week and is in the Senate right now.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about then how the conversation around immigration has changed. I mean, we have the Utah Compact, of course, which basically is, committed to promoting common sense immigration reforms, strengthening our economy, and attracting talent and business, and just the tone that we use around immigration. Again, it was signed in 2010 and then reaffirmed again in 2019.
Yeah, so as you said, this really advocates for bipartisan common sense approaches to immigration, and was really seen as a roadmap that not just Utah could use, but states around the country could use to approach this issue. I've heard people describe to me as immigration as the political football everyone loves to pass around. Political scientists have told me it's a beautiful election issue because it is so easy to fight about and is so polarizing for so many people. And frankly, there are incentives, political incentives on both sides of this to not address it in a meaningful way. And the Utah Compact on Immigration was seen as a way to meaningfully address the issue of immigration in a bipartisan manner. And I think when you look at what has been proposed this year, some of it is in direct conflict with a lot of the things that were talked about in the Utah Compact. And like I said earlier, the 2024 election really made immigration and border security a number one focus for a lot of people. And I think we're seeing a lot of reaction to that. Whether President Trump did not win the election in 2024, would we still be seeing some of those bills? I'm not sure. There have been some some immigration lawyers who have said this is the bandwagon effect. These lawmakers want to show that they are supporting the president's agenda and want to show fealty in some way, that they support his moves on immigration and some of these deportation measures. And yeah, I think we'll just see.
Okay. And I don't have much to say about it other than I just want to end on a positive note. House Bill 318, basically good news that Democrats and the Utah Eagle Forum can agree on something.
Yes, the civics education amendments. I will say Representative Wilton, a Republican, he's a public school teacher himself. So can't say I'm surprised to see him push for more civics education. This would add a social studies graduation requirement, more social studies instruction in schools, and just makes young people a little bit more aware of the world around them and how government works. I remember some civics was one of my favorite subjects in high school and part of the reason I became a reporter. So I'm happy to see this one getting some bipartisan support.
All right. Sean Higgins, KUER reporter. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Good morning. In the studio now with an update from Recycle Utah, General Manager Jim Bedell. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie.
So you have taken over the day-to-day operations since Carolyn Morris stepped down to a part-time position to focus on her rehab. Any changes you've made or foresee making?
No, in terms of the way we operate. I think we've had a 30-some-odd year track record of understanding how to properly run sustainability initiatives in a recycling center in the community. So there's no real need to do anything other than not mess up what my predecessors have set up.
Okay, so is this a full-time job for you, or are you both working part-time?
No, I'm full-time and intend to be involved in this role until we solve our future diversion needs.
All right. And that is something you have been doing, meeting with both city and county officials to get some movement on a new recycling center. And we heard from you last month that building a regional recycling center is not the responsibility of Recycle Utah. This is a government operation. So do you have government officials agreeing with you?
That's a good question. I'll tell you what we do have, which is very encouraging, is shortly after our second public presentation in January, we received a very pleasant invitation from Park City Municipal Government and Summit County government officials, including the mayor and the chair of the county council and senior staff, to come discuss this issue. And that was, I think, a very good first step forward for us. They made a presentation to us and a proposal that could help with some of our diversion needs. And we have a follow-up meeting next week to talk a little bit further about how we go forward.
All right, so what are some of the constraints that you're hearing about?
I don't know if we're at the point now of hearing about constraints. Over the last year or so, as a result of all the research we've done and the consultants we've hired, I think our knowledge of where our community stands with respect to landfill diversion and recycling, broadly speaking, is much higher. The knowledge is much higher than it was before. So we know how far behind we are, and we know what type of investments other communities have made. And I think we're still digesting that as a community. You know, Recycle Utah, we've been aware of that because we're involved in the process. I think city and county officials now understand it. The fact that they invited us to a meeting and made a proposal, I think, shows that they're beginning to understand it. We have a fairly strong belief as an organization based on the research we've done and discussions with other communities who have succeeded in doing this as to what needs to happen. And I think the challenge for us will be figuring out whether the community as a whole and the two governments share our view that we need a fairly sizable investment rather than smaller steps forward. But just to be clear, as a community and as an organization, we are committed to making the right investment.
Yeah, and so you say sizable investment. I mean, what was it, 20, 40? What was
$25 million is the budget we presented at the meeting, and think that still works. And of that amount, Recycle Utah has offered to the city and the county to contribute up to $5 million. As you correctly said, we think most of the responsibility for municipal waste management should fall on municipalities, and the largest burden should be shared by the government.
Yeah, and would Republic Services be at all interested?
In what sense?
In being a partner?
As part of the research we did, we had pretty extensive discussions with all the haulers, not just Republic, who currently do the curbside collection and waste management for the county, but Ace, who's also a hauler who services us, Momentum, who do glass and food waste, as well as some of the smaller operations here in town. Everybody on the hauling side is quite enthusiastic about having a facility up here to bring material to save them these expensive, environmentally damaging trips up and down the canyon each and every day. So we haven't had a conversation about whether any of those organizations would be looking to financially contribute, if that's what you're asking, but they clearly see the upside for them and presumably value to the county in terms of contracts going forward and having a facility here.
Yeah, so are the city and county, are they, a partner in terms of, I mean, they've kind of agreed on what they're willing to do, Or are we still talking about three different entities, city, county, Recycle Utah?
I think that's a better question to ask the city and the county, yeah. but I'll give you my perception. I mean, it was great that we got an invitation from the two of them to meet, and they'd clearly given some thought to this and put a proposal on the table. So to me, that suggests very encouragingly that they're willing to talk together about this. So
yeah, I guess I'm just saying they come as a single front here to, you know, this is what they agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Can you talk a little bit about what they're proposing?
Let me start with what we're proposing, which is basically what we presented to the public, which is the $25 million investment, a hub and spoke type of system like other communities have successfully implemented here in the Mountain West. We didn't get into, at that initial meeting, the details of precisely whether that's the right type of model or not. The proposal we got from the city and the county just contemplated a smaller investment amount. Again, I'm hesitating a little bit because I don't think it's for me to say what they're thinking, but they put a proposal on the table that just contemplates a lower investment level than we think is necessary.
Okay. So stay tuned because you say you have another meeting next week. We'll know more maybe next month.
Absolutely. Hope so.
All right. Let's see. You've got two events. First, March 8th. This is a second collection event for North Summit residents. How does this work?
First of all, sorry to correct you. It's actually March 9th, Saturday.
Oh, okay.
I might have sent you the wrong information. But yes, we'll be doing a remote recycling collection event out at the Ledges parking lot in Colville from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, March 9th. As you said, we did this in January, and we're very pleasantly surprised to collect over 1,000 pounds of material from North Summit residents on a snowy Saturday in January. So we're looking forward to equal or even greater success on this next event.
Yeah, so what will you collect?
We'll be collecting cardboard, electronic waste, plastics, and batteries.
Yeah. Are you doing this as kind of a way to show the county the demand for a future regional facility?
I think this started because there was a U.S. Department of Agriculture grant available a year and a half ago that caught our attention, and it was designed to focus on what the USDA defined as more rural parts of American communities. And when we did our research, we saw that Colville, you know, was qualified as a rural community here in need of support for recycling. So it was more just an opportunity to reach out a little bit further from our base here in Park City. And one of the things we learned in talking to residents as they were dropping material off is they were very enthusiastic because it's a long trip from where they live to where our current recycling center is. And if they do want to dispose of materials, they're kind of constrained in their ability. So they were enthusiastically embracing us being out there.
So you haven't dropped off any dumpsters like you do maybe at Jeremy Ranch?
No. And that, as you do know, is something we've contemplated in this new hub and spoke model. So this is also a good way for us to be able to validate the idea that people in other parts of our county that we're not currently really serving properly are indeed interested.
Yeah. So how often will you host these?
Till the money runs out. We intend to do another one in the spring. We're talking with Mayor Marsh and Colville about precisely what dates we should focus on them. But I'm sure we'll be able to do at least three or four more events.
Yeah. And you're putting out plenty of information in terms of when and where so that people will kind of collect their stuff?
Exactly. I mean, the mayor's been very good about promoting it in Colville. The county's been good about promoting it. Our own education team will be in North Summit schools next week and promoting it among the students.
All right. And then March 11th, you've got another Green Drinks happening at Red Flower Studios. What's the topic here?
The topic is the future of transportation, mobility, and sustainability. And we'll hear from two sets of speakers. Kevin Staples from Salt Lake City Airport will be talking about the challenges and innovations shaping greener air travel. And also closer to home, Park City Municipal Transportation leaders Tim Sanderson and Alex Roy will be providing updates on key transit, biking, and pedestrian projects shaping the future of mobility in our community.
Okay, so what time does this happen?
This is from 6 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, March 11th at Red Flower Studios. And one thing, Leslie, if I could just mention while I have people's attention here, these events are very, very popular, and we don't charge for them, but they do sell out in terms of capacity. And we've had an increasing issue lately of people registering and they're not coming, which removes the opportunity for others to come. So I would kindly ask that if you do register and your plans change and you can't make it, give us a call or go to our website and unregister so that we can open a spot to somebody else.
Okay. And they do need to register online then to do that. Anything else you want to mention?
No, thanks, Leslie.
All right, Jim, thank you. Talk to you next month.